And what inspired this is the idea of big Passover Seders. When we were, like I said here during the break, Angie and I have been invited to teach a couple of these big Passover Seders. And the reason people want these taught is because as the Jewish Roots Movement, which is what this movement is basically called from the beginning, was called the Jewish Roots Movement back 15, 20 years ago, as people start getting into this walk and they're starting to see the importance of the things of God, and they're starting to see that they shouldn't be participating in some of the other practices that they had been practicing, then they want to do Jewish things. And a lot of people will don tzitzit, a lot of people will take start wearing a kippah or something like that. But they'll also, when they start giving up Christmas and Easter and things like that, they want to start getting involved in the Jewish festivals. And one of the most popular Jewish festivals is Passover. In fact, there are probably more Baptist Passover Seders than any other group combined, or all other groups combined, outside of Judaism itself. Because the Baptist people are starting to walk this way, or they're starting to see advantages of doing this stuff, and they're doing it, and they're getting involved in it. But unfortunately, what we see in a lot of these Seders is this type of thing. Now, you may not be able to see it in the back here. There's so much light in here. I'll tell you what, I'm going to turn these lights off. Hopefully everybody can see. You get these great big Passover Seders, and is that really the thing that God wants people to do? Is God really looking for big groups of people coming together, oftentimes having to pay to get in, buy tickets for it, and maybe even pay for the meal that night? Those are some of the things that we're seeing. And as Passover becomes more and more prevalent, you know, we're going to be seeing more of this. But the festivals of God that were given to God's people, not as for a banquet purpose. God's festivals are given to us to teach us about Him, teach us about our Messiah, and to teach about the plan of salvation that God has established for all of us so that we can eventually be a part of His kingdom. And it's not to say that God doesn't want us to be involved in the festivals. In fact, God even instructs all peoples to go up to the Feast of Tabernacles. It says in Zechariah 14, "And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." And if you continue to read that passage, you would see that even implies that the king of Egypt, even though he's not necessarily walking in the ways of God, he's still expected to come up and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So God expects people to attend his festivals, but Passover is a little bit different. And what makes Passover different is that Passover has to do with a covenantal relationship with God. It's all about the covenant. And so because it's a covenantal relationship, Passover is a more intimate festival, you might say, than all the other festivals. It's a very intimate. And thus you would see things like this. This is more of what we should see in Passover, at least my opinion, because God reserves Passover for His covenant people. This is the kind of thing that we should see. So instead of a banquet, it's like a private meal, and it's with your closest friends and family. And to keep Passover private, God established some rules for Passover that He didn't necessarily apply to the rest of the festivals. So what we're going to do today is we're going to take a look at what God had to say about Passover and how and who should be keeping it. And we'll discuss the various Passover requirements listed in the Torah to see how they apply to us. And then in a later, actually it's going to be this next weekend, this next Sabbath, we're going to talk about a very unique Passover that happened nearly 1,000 years after the very first Passover, because it casts a little bit different light on some of the things that I'm going to say today. It's not to say that we're saying one thing today, we're going to say something different, but we're going to be adding to next week what we're saying today. So don't take what I say today as everything that there is to be said about Passover. All right, so that's what we're going to do. So here we go. The first Passover was in conjunction with the Exodus story. And we all remember that. In Exodus Let me see. Exodus 22:23, it says, "Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to Yahweh because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham." God remembered his covenant. The covenant with Abraham is what actually inspired the Passover. Because just like we read today, when in the Haftarah portion in Ezekiel, that God is not doing anything because of us. He's doing it for his namesake, which means because of the covenant he made with the fathers. And so it's because of this covenant relationship God has with Abraham and subsequently with all the children of Jacob that God was compelled to have to do the or bring about the Exodus, which included the Passover. So remember, it's a very covenantal thing. It's also important to realize that there has only been one Passover. Now, this may seem strange, and I'll explain it more, but there's only been one Passover. What we do today in our observance of Passover is that we remember the original Passover. The night that Yahweh protected his people from the destroyer who was going to destroy all the firstborn. Let's look at the instructions that God gave to Moses. It says in Exodus 12:25, "And when you come to the land that the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall keep this service," speaking of Passover. "And when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this service?' you shall say to them, 'It is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians and spared our houses.'" So you notice he's saying to look back. You're to be looking back at something that happened before. And we see this over and over and over again in the Scripture, and especially in the Torah. We see God saying, "Remember the Passover. Remember the time in Israel. Remember the time that I redeemed you out of Egypt." In fact, if you were there last week, when Eddie was here, Jim Cowan made the statement that it says that over 200 times in the Tanakh, to remember this event. So this event is very important to God. Where am I at? Okay. So there has only been one Passover. And again, to reiterate this, the point, Exodus 13, "Remember this day in which you came out from Egypt, out from the house of bondage, for by strength of hand Yahweh brought you out from this place. There shall be no leavened bread." So God actually established the days of unleavened bread as a continual reminder of this event. It's such a big event that not only do we remember that night, we remember the actual coming out of Egypt also by keeping these 7 days of unleavened bread after that. Again, it was this very first Passover to be memorialized. We'll see another passage here in Exodus 12. "And this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and you shall keep it a feast to Yahweh throughout your generations. You shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever." Now, this Hebrew word here for memorial is an important word. The word there is zekar, and it's a Zion, kaf and a resh. Zion, kaf, resh. And what it means, it simply means call to mind. Zekar means call to mind. But if you take the pictures the Hebrew word pictures of that, it's sort of like taking and drilling a hole in your head and pouring that information in. It's the Zion, you know, is a weapon, and the kaf is the hand, and then the resh is the head itself. So you're sort of pouring these thoughts into your mind. To always have this before you. It's really important that God wanted us to always call this to mind, always keep this on our mind. The very first Passover was very unique, and there has never been a Passover like it. And in fact, it's been a few months ago actually, I was talking to this guy in another church congregation. And he was telling me that God does change because he changed the Passover. And And I can see his reasoning, because he sees that the first Passover was this way, and then subsequent Passovers were different. And then, of course, the Christian Passover, you might say, is different even still. But God did not change the Passover, because there's only been one Passover. He's just created a way to remember the first Passover, and the way you remember the first Passover is not to take and do the same things again. How do we remember 9/11? Do we go out and take planes and fly them into buildings in order to remember it? No. We do something different to remember the original event. So let's look at some of the things that have changed in this Passover. First thing is that in the first Passover, the lamb was killed at the door of the home. In subsequent Passovers, the lamb was killed at the tabernacle. In the first Passover, the blood was painted on the doorpost. And in subsequent Passovers, the blood sprinkled on the altar. Well, that's sure not very clear, is it? All right. Yeah, it's got a shadow. It doesn't show that way on my computer. And then the third is that you eat it in haste with shoes on and staff in your hand. This is the first Passover. But in all subsequent Passovers, there's no requirement for haste. So we see that the first Passover was unique in the way that it was observed. And we don't do the same things today. The Zecher that we observe today is not the same as the first Passover. Nevertheless, the subsequent Passovers have a lot of meaning. We can't say that because subsequent Passovers were not the original and not the same, that the subsequent Passovers are different, because they are to teach us, they're to remind us of what happened, but teach us what's getting ready to happen. And as we know, there's going to be a great Passover that's going to take place, or a great Exodus that's going to take place. And so we should be always keeping these things again in mind so we understand that. God, in his wisdom, knew that as Israel went into the promised land, they were going to come in contact with peoples that didn't necessarily walk the same walk as they did. And because of that, God established certain instructions for the observance of Passover to keep Passover a sanctified event, you might say, a more holy event than maybe some of the other festivals that God gave. And so what we're going to do here from this point on is we're going to look at some of these, or look at basically all of the passages I found in the Torah pertaining to how the Passover was to be observed. And we'll find some interesting things. So this is the first major text, and I just want to go ahead and read this text first, and then we're going to pull parts of it out. Exodus 12, verse 43 says, "And Yahweh said to Moshe and Aaron, 'This is the statute of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it, but every slave that is bought for money may eat of it after you have circumcised him. No foreigner or hired servant may eat of it. It shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any of the flesh outside of the house, and you shall not break any of the bones. All of the congregation of Israel shall keep it. If a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to Yahweh, let all his males be circumcised, and he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. There shall be one law for the native and one for the stranger who sojourns with you.'" Now, it sounds like an awful lot there, but basically there's only two commandments in that. And we'll look at those. First of them is that you shall not break any of its bones. Did you know that there's nothing in the Torah that tells you that they're told the Israelites at the very first Passover they could not offer lamb that they could not break the bones of the Passover lamb? It's not in the text of any of the original, but it's in the Septuagint. And I find that very interesting. The Septuagint was written by the Jewish priests and various rabbis in the 2nd century B.C. And for some reason, even though it's not in the text, they added that passage, "You shall not break any of his bones." Now, this is in this text, but it's not in the text of any previous instructions, except in the instruction where God told the Israelites to gather the lamb. That's where it told them in the Septuagint to not break any of its bones. I find that quite interesting that they would do that. Greg, you turn the heat on?
No, the air conditioner just went off. Okay.
So anyway, this is the first commandment in here. You shall not break any of its bones. So from this point on, when the Israelites were to take and offer up a Passover lamb, they had to make sure that they didn't break any of its bones. I see this as a messianic instruction that God added to all subsequent Passovers that he didn't put in the very first Passover. Okay? Second thing is this. God says, no foreigner shall eat of it. Now, basically everything here is summarized in these two verses. But I think that we want to take and break these things down even further to see specifically what it's talking about. So these are the two laws that we find in this passage. You shall not break any of its bones. No foreigner shall eat of it. So let's move on. Let's look at this no foreigner shall eat of it. There's a number of words here that seem confusing. In fact, it seems somewhat contradictory at times because we see in one place it says no foreigner shall eat of it, but it says a stranger can eat of it. And what is the difference in all these things? And why is it that some people can and some people can't eat of it? We're going to go through all that. It's not really that difficult. The first part of that passage where it says no foreigner shall eat of it, the Hebrew word there is ben neker. Now we know what ben is. Ben is son. Neker is a stranger. Now, some of us, in some passages, it spells this as a nokri. And what a ben neker is, it's a person who is hostile to Israel and to Israel's culture. A person's hostile to Israel and to Israel's culture. And it could also be, though it's not necessarily that so, it could also be an idol worshiper. It could be someone who's an atheist, who just simply has no use for God. Okay? It's just someone who is hostile. He says, you religious people, you go out and you have your guns and your religion, you know. This is the type of person that God is saying shall not eat the Passover. All right, the next type of person is the foreigner or hired servant. No foreigner or hired servant may eat of it. And the words there are toshav for foreigner and sakir for servant. Tashav and secure. And so let's look and see what those words mean. A tashav is a person who is just passing through. It's like this. Remember God said that Israel, I don't know if God said it, but we know that Israel was placed right where it is in the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea. And it's right in the very thoroughfare of going from Asia, if you're going to go from Europe or Asia down to Africa, you pass through Israel. God knew this. This was a very busy place. And there's going to be a lot of people just passing through. And if those people pass through, and if they happen to pass through on the evening of the 14th of Nisan, or the next afternoon, and they see everybody together, they're going to say, what are y'all doing? Getting ready to have a big old feast, looks like. Of course, everybody's going to Jerusalem. So they're saying, well, I'll just go to Jerusalem too. I got some spare time. So I'm just going to go. And they'll go there, and they're seeing that we're going to have a big feast there, and they're going to have lamb, and we all love lamb because lamb's expensive nowadays. And so they say they may want to eat of it. All right? Well, God says no. The tashav cannot eat of it. A person just passing through can't eat it. The other word is a sakir, or a seasonal worker, or even a mercenary. And what it is a person who comes into Israel, does his job, and then leaves. You just come in for a short time. You're not interested in anything Israel has to do except get their money. And then you leave. All right? We have people who just pass through the Messianic movement. They're religious tourists, you might call them. Okay? So I think this is a very fitting thing and very interesting that we see it this way, because it pretty much points to where we are today. But a tashav and a sakir shall not eat of the Passover. All right, the next group says, if a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover of the Lord, let his males be circumcised. What is the difference between a stranger and a sakir or a foreigner, a nokri? What's the difference in those? Well, it's because Well, we'll just go through it. It says, a stranger shall not sojourn with you. The words there for stranger is ger. And the word for sojourn is gur. And actually, they're the same two words. The ger and the gur are the same thing, pretty much. A gur, or a sojourner, is derived from the Greek, or from the Hebrew word ger. It's from the root ger. And let's look at what those are. A ger is an alien who wants to dwell with you. It's a person who wants to dwell with you. Now, you've got this situation up here. It's in a different passage. If you've got a slave, oh, here it is. Verse 44. But every slave that is bought for money may eat of it after you have circumcised him. Okay? What is it about a slave that would cause a slave to be able to eat of it after he's circumcised? Is he not a mercenary, or would he be like an alien? Why not? Well, I submit two reasons. Number one, if you've got slaves working for you, then they're going to be a part of your household, and they fall under your jurisdiction. All right? Secondly is this. Remember, there was a situation where if you had a slave, and the slave loved his master, and he didn't want to leave, and he would take him, have his ear pricked to the side of the doorpost. What he's saying is that, I love my master, I want to be like my master. And if he's going to be like his master, that means he's going to be wanting to walk like his master. And so I think that's why we see that. And that's basically the same thing right here with the ger. You have the alien who wants to dwell with you, and basically that means he wants to assimilate into the host culture. Now keep in mind that Israel was a culturally religious people. They're like the America used to be. Used to be here in America, we were a religious people. And when people came to America, they either became a Catholic or they became a Protestant. Nowadays, when people come to America, they remain a Buddhist, or they'll remain a Muslim or something like that. They don't assimilate into the American Judeo-Christian culture like they used to. But a ger, by definition, would be a person who wanted to assimilate and become a part of the culture of the Israelite people. In fact, the Jews would call, they translate ger through the Septuagint as a proselyte. And we all understand what a proselyte is. A proselyte is a person who is wanting to become a Jew, in the first century at least. So you see the difference? That's why a ger could be a part and keep Passover. And of course, there is the requirement to be circumcised in that. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. Let me catch up with where I'm at. Now, there's a good example of this situation of a ger wanting to be a part of the culture of the people. And that's right here in the book of Ruth. Ruth, you know, we have Naomi. Naomi had a husband, and both sons die within a short period of time. And the two sons had two different wives, but they were Moabite wives. And so when Naomi was wanting to return back to Israel, he told his Moabite daughter-in-laws and said, you guys stay right here. Well, the one said, no, I'm going to stay. Well, the one actually agreed. She said, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to worship the gods of Moab. In effect, you could say that she was a Nakri, because she was going to worship the pagan gods. But Ruth says, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and there you lodge, I will go. Your people shall be my people, and your God shall be my God. So Ruth is a ger. She is a person who is wanting to assimilate into Naomi's religion, and Naomi's religion was Hebrew, because she was going back to the land of the Hebrews. So where does the circumcision come into it? For a ger to sojourn means that he wanted to be a part of the covenant. He was wanting to be a part of the covenant that Israel had, And that is, and that covenant that Israel had was the covenant God made with Abraham. So the circumcision simply signaled to God that this person wanted to be a covenant person. But more importantly, what it signals is a change in that Ger's heart. That Ger does not want to remain in the culture from which he or she came. That Ger wants to now, they've changed their heart toward God. And that's what we see with Ruth. Ruth didn't want to remain in the culture of Moab. She wanted to be a part of the culture of her mother-in-law, of Naomi. And so that's all that circumcision is. Circumcision is not the physical act is not as important as the change in your heart. And God is looking for the change in your heart, not necessarily a physical act. And again, we'll talk about some of this even more as we go on, maybe probably not this week, but we will next week. So once that person was circumcised, that person could then draw near. If a stranger sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to Yahweh, let all his males be circumcised, then he may come near. So the circumcision is the point that God says, okay, now you can draw near to me. The Hebrew word there for draw near is karab, karab. And it's the same word from which we get the Hebrew korban. And what is korban? It's the offerings. The offerings and the sacrifices are called korban. All right? So this is the purpose of this whole portion of Passover, is to take and have people who want to take and come near to God and become a Hebrew like the Israelites. Karab. So another interesting thing, it says, once he has been circumcised, he shall be as a native of the land. And the word there for native of the land is one word, and it's Ezrach. Ezrach. And it simply means a tree that has sprung up from the land. And the thought behind this is that it's a tree that has sprung up from the land of Israel. So an Ezrach is someone who has been planted in the land, and now they're springing forth. And the concept of springing forth is what God wants from us. He wants us to take and spring up as a new life and become a new person. And what's interesting about this phrase right here is that when Moses repeated this to the Israelites, he says, he shall be as a native of the land. How many natives of the land were in Israel at that time? Zero. How many of the children of Israel coming out of Egypt were natives of the land? There was none. There was not a single person who was born in Israel who came out of Egypt. They're all born in Egypt, right? So what God is in effect saying, and I know I would get criticism from some areas for saying, that a Ger could become more Hebrew than a Hebrew. I find this very interesting. And then it goes on to say, there shall be one law for the native and for the Ger. One law for the native and the Ger. This flies in the face of one of the current theologies out there that God has made a distinction between the Jewish people and the non-Jewish people. But God clearly says that the Ger and the Israelite will all have the same law. Now, as we go on, we'll find other places and more places where it talks about requirements for Passover. And one of those is Numbers 9. So let the children of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time. On the 14th day of this month at twilight, you shall keep it at its appointed time according to all its rites and ceremonies. All right. The Hebrew word there for rites is hukah, or hok. Hok is actually. And hok simply means statutes and judgments. What this is saying is that you refer back to the previous passage in Exodus 12 that we just got through talking about. Because that's where we see the hok up to this point, the statutes and the judgments pertaining to Passover. We find them in Exodus 12. Now, we find in Exodus 12 not only all the hoke or the statutes and judgments for the subsequent Passovers, but we find them for the first Passover. But what God is going to do is He's going to start separating out the first Passover from all the subsequent Passovers. And so we look at this passage here, Leviticus 17:3, and this is one of the first things, differentiations He makes. It says, if any of the house of Israel kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp or kills it outside the camp and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer it as a gift to Yahweh in front of the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guilt shall be imputed upon him. What that is saying is this. God is saying all sacrifices will now be offered at the tabernacle. All sacrifices offered at the tabernacle. That includes the Passover sacrifice. So here we see the Passover sacrifice being moved from an individual's home to the tabernacle. Do we see that? And along with that, then, are some other requirements. Because by moving it to the tabernacle, there are matters of holiness and stuff that have to be dealt with. So since the Passover was moved to the tabernacle, first off, the priest had to take care of the blood. All sacrifices that were offered at the tabernacle were killed by the offerer, but the priest collected the blood. So now there's a priesthood that has to take part in the Passover. There was no priesthood that had to take part in the first Passover in Egypt. So this is where we see the priesthood taking part. And then secondly, because now they were going to be approaching the tabernacle, the offerer had to be in a ceremonially clean state. He had to be in a ceremonially clean state. Now, this caused a problem for some people. Because as we read today, there are things that can make you unclean. You know, if we eat a pork roast, that's going to make us unclean, right? Okay. Well, there's a lot of things that could make us unclean. And this is the one specifically that we're going to deal with right now. Well, okay. Numbers 9, verse 10, 11 says, speak to the children of Israel, saying, if any of you or your descendants is unclean through touching a dead body or is on a long journey, he shall still keep the Passover to Yahweh. In the second month, on the 14th day of the at twilight, he shall keep it. I got a little bit ahead of myself here. But we understand, we remember this passage. This is as a result of, because the Passover was moved to the tabernacle, we had some men, doesn't say how many, we assume it's two, but there were some men who had to bury a dead body. And because they buried this body, they became unclean via a corpse. They touched a corpse. And apparently this was right on the day of Passover, so therefore they couldn't keep the Passover. And so they went to Moses and said, Moses, why should we be forbidden from giving the offering to God, giving the sacrifice to God? And Moses says, let me talk to God and see what God has to say. And this is what God's answer was. And so God is, in His grace, He has given us an opportunity to keep Passover if we have to on the second month, if it's, but only for these two reasons. One is through corpse uncleanliness, and the second is off, if we're off on a journey. You cannot keep Passover the second month simply because you don't want to keep it the first month. And you can't keep it the second month for other reasons that have nothing to do with corpse uncleanliness. In other words, even sickness is not defined here as a reason for not keeping the Passover on the first month. Only corpse uncleanliness and being off on a journey. Minette?
Well, that's on the side, even sickness, you know, because you come around other people.
Yeah. All I'm saying is what that text says. And so, but we're actually going to be looking at this, though, more next week, okay? But if we look at the text, that's what it says. Touching a dead body, corpse uncleanliness, and being on a long journey. And you know, these were understood to be unintentional things. You know, You're not, if you see a possum out there in your yard, and it's the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan, and you say, well, I got something I could do tonight, so I think I'll just go touch that possum. It's going to make me poor, corpse unclean, so I don't have to keep Passover tonight. That's not kosher.
Could you elaborate on a long journey? It seems to me like that's an elective thing.
Well, I think what it's talking about is in an area where you simply can't get back. I don't know, but it does. That's what it says. If it's a long journey,
so. When he was on his mission trip, was rushing to get back to Jerusalem. Something happened.
Mm-hmm. Right. Doesn't count. All right. All right. So anyway, we see the context of what God is saying. All right. Now there are some more passages that add a little bit more to the requirements for Passover, and that's in Deuteronomy 16 verses 5 through 7. Here it says, "You may not offer the Passover sacrifice within any of your towns that Yahweh your God is giving you." Okay, we understand that because if it's only can be offered at the tabernacle, that eliminates every place else, right? But then look what else it says. "But at the place that Yahweh your God will choose to make his name dwell in it, there you shall offer the Passover sacrifice." And we understand that. And there's only been two places that God has placed his name through all history. One was at Shiloh. This is where the tabernacle was placed when Joshua brought the children of Israel in into Israel. It was at Shiloh, and then the second place was at Jerusalem. And we know that because when Solomon was giving his prayer in 1 Kings 8 for the dedication of the temple, and he says, you know, this is the place where you placed your name, God acknowledged that by doing what? Same thing we read today. Took the fire, went in there, and consumed the offering. Okay, that's God's way of saying, hey, I'm with you, buddy. All right, so That's how we know. And so there's only been two places. And quite interestingly, if you were to ever take a satellite view of Shiloh area and a satellite view of Jerusalem area, in both cases, there's a shin. The terrain makes a shin. I don't have a marker, but everybody know what a shin looks like?
Okay. Out of the mountains?
Yeah, out of the mountains and the valleys. Yeah.
I knew a shin. Mm. How far is Shiloh from Jerusalem?
Shiloh is up in the land of Ephraim, about probably 100 miles maybe.
Well, that's interesting, Judah and Ephraim.
But it's interesting in Jerusalem because, you know, the dot in the shin, that makes the shin, that is where the Temple Mount is. If you take and lay this all out topographically and put the shin on there, the dot on the shin, the dagash on the shin, will be where the Temple Mount is. So it's really interesting. Yes, Lori?
So when they came out of Egypt in that Passover, and when the children came out of the wilderness and into the land, mm-hmm. it was Pesach.
Right.
And it was 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think they kept Passover in the wilderness.
I don't think they did. Yeah. And so the first that there was the Pesach, the one and only
right.
Passover, and then the remembrance. And I can now remember the scripture that says, "And when you come into the land, you'll remember when I took you out." And so it is when they came into the land is when they started the remembrance.
Well, actually, that's not true. They did keep one Passover in the wilderness.
They kept the one.
Yeah, this is why they're still camped at Mount Sinai. They kept Passover that year. We know for sure now. We don't know that they kept any subsequent ones. It doesn't say so. All right. So let's review real quickly what we've covered today. First off, the first Passover was unique. There's never been a Passover since it, like it since. All subsequent Passovers are to remember the first. Along with many of the instructions pertaining to the first Passover, God gave these instructions for each subsequent Passover. And what I'm saying here is that there are some instructions that God gave at the first. One is you're not to go out of your house. You're not to leave any of it till morning. These things were given in the first Passover, and they, I believe, are carried over in the second one. How that would apply to us today in some areas would be difficult to understand. But anyway, some of the new things were that anyone who eats it must be circumcised. And we know that not everybody was circumcised in the first one. Because, well, I can't say that we know. We strongly assume. Because we strongly assume that there are Egyptians who kept the Passover. They killed the lamb, put the blood on the doorpost. And it would be because culturally they would not have been circumcised. Then the requirement for circumcision is for the subsequent Passovers, not for the first one. It must be killed in the place Yahweh has placed his name. The priests play a role in the sacrifice. And a person must be ceremonially clean to kill the Passover lamb. Something we don't think about. So for us today, one of the things we might want to think about before we observe Passover is no sexual relationship the night before or the day of, because that would make you unclean. Yeah. And secondly, to avoid touching anything that would make you unclean that day. Okay, it's just something if we wanted to try to apply some of these things more ourselves. And the fifth thing here is it must be eaten in the place Yahweh placed his name. And I didn't really cover that well in the previous passage, but there in the Deuteronomy 16 passage, it says that it must be eaten in the place where God placed his name. What that means is that you can't go to the temple and kill your Passover and then take it to Bethlehem and eat it. You've got to eat your Passover lamb within the city of Jerusalem. Now, they say in the city of Jerusalem, the borders of Jerusalem extended beyond the walled city in order to satisfy this commandment. Because you had a million people coming to keep Passover. They say that over 200,000 lambs were killed on the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan. So that's an awful lot of lambs. They all had to be eaten within the city of Jerusalem. So this is what this is. So anyway, those are the things that we want to consider as far as Passover is concerned in our Passovers coming up, and how we would want to observe Passover. And the thing that we want to see, first off, is this concept of anyone who eats it must be circumcised. And to be circumcised, I mean, for a person to even become circumcised, if they're not already an Israelite walking in the way and they're a ger, they've got to be someone who's walking this way. They've got to be headed this way. They should not be someone who's just passing through. We don't want any toshavs at Passover. We don't want tourists at Passover. We want people who are dedicated to the walk and wanting to walk this way. That's what it's all about. All right? Now, I want to throw in here why we don't kill a Passover lamb today. Because there's some question about that. And, well, just before that, most people believe that we don't kill a Passover lamb today for what? You know what the most common thought is? Does anybody have it in mind?
Because we don't have a temple.
No, even more so than that.
Sacrifices
are done away with at the death of Messiah. Messiah is the Passover lamb that died for us and that did away with all the sacrifices. That's the most common thought. But the only biblical thought is here. The biblical thought is that the temple and the temple where the place where the lambs are to be killed no longer exists. Secondly, without the ashes of the red heifer, we are all in a state of ritual impurity and thus cannot approach the temple. If we were offering sacrifices today and we were to offer our Passover lamb, we would have to be ceremonially clean to do so. And the only way we can become ceremonially clean is via the ashes of the red heifer, because that cleanses you from corpse uncleanliness. And we all have corpse uncleanliness because we've all come in contact in some way with dead. We walked over a grave or something like that. So we would all have to have the ashes of the red heifer.
Okay, isn't walking over the grave something that's been added?
I don't know. It may be. I've always thought it was there, but I'll have to look that up and see.
Yeah.
There's a number of things. So. Okay, and then the third thing is, without the temple and the ashes, the red heifer, there is no active priesthood to take part in the sacrifice, which is now required, because the role of the priest in the Passover is to take the blood and sprinkle it on the altar. So, without the Passover, or without that, we can't do it. So, anyway, these are the things we need to consider. Next week, we'll talk about another Passover that helps give more understanding to these things that we've talked about today. Again, this is not the final word on who can observe Passover and how it should be observed, but this is a place to start off.